they have enabled, you know, the mega rich to buy influence and access to the Supreme Court as well. You know, one of the most stunning lines, I think, in the Supreme Court's opinion is from Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission, where they suggested that massive amounts of political spending would, of course, not lead to the appearance of corruption and not cause Americans to lose faith in our democracy. And I think we've all seen what Elon Musk did, pour in several hundred millions of dollars and thereby basically purchase himself the presidency and access to the presidency. And you're telling me that doesn't give off the stench of corruption and doesn't cause people to question our democracy? Come on, get real.
All right, folks. You're going to need it today, baby. Trust me. My guest is Leah Lipman. She is a professor of law at the University of Michigan and a former Supreme Court clerk. In addition to co-hosting Strict Scrutiny, she writes frequently about the court for media and other outlets, including the Washington Post, Slate, and The Atlantic. She's appeared as a commentator on NPR and my network of MSNBC, as well as other spots on the telly, as they say. She has received the Ruth Bader Ginsburg Award for her scholarly excellence from the American Constitution Society and published in top law reviews. But all of that is the backdrop for her visit with us today. And that is her new book, Lawless: How the Supreme Court Runs on Conservative Grievance, Fringe Theories, and Bad Vibes. We get into those bad vibes. We get into that grievance, those fringe theories. We get into all of it, which is why I brought along my little friend. You're going to need one, too, as we have this conversation today with Leah Lipman right here on the Michael Steele podcast coming up after this. Hey, folks, Michael Steele here. Welcome to the Michael Steele podcast. So I'm just going to tell you up front. If you don't have an adult beverage, you better go get one, because this conversation, your nerves going to get fried a little bit. It's going to piss you off at some points. I'm telling you now, just warning you. You know me. I got mine. And mine right here. So
can I say don't shoot the messenger at this point?
Oh my gosh. No, please don't shoot the messenger, because this messenger is bringing it and keeping it real. Leah Lipman, thank you so much for being on the podcast. I'm really excited to get into your new book and just the whole idea, you know, lawless. And who would think that you would apply that term in a story, in a expose of a conversation about our Supreme Court? It's just on its face, it's just sort of stunning, because I can tell you, and you know this well from your work, that 20 years ago, that would be, if people look at you like you had seven heads. and even I would say 10 years ago, they may not look like you had seven heads, but they still look at you a little cockeyed. Now people go, yeah, what the hell do you expect? So talk to us about Lawless, how the Supreme Court runs on conservative grievance, fringe theories, and bad vibes. Just overall set where you were going with this book.
Yes. So the subtitle does convey a lot of it. It is meant to explain how the Supreme Court, and specifically the six Republican justices, are basically making the Republican Party's talking points and their own feelings into the law. That's what I mean by vibes. You know, they're more feeling-ish, more subjective, more the zeitgeist, not so much what we think of as law, things that are determinant or objective. And
yeah. Yeah, just so I can frame that, because you actually, it's an important part of how you set the book up. You say that it's no longer, Supreme Court's no longer practicing law. It is actually running on this kind of vibe thing. And that gets into how they feel and how put upon conservatives are. And, oh, poor little boobies, they just can't tie their shoes anymore because the big old bad liberals are, you know, that kind of thing, right?
That is very much the conservative grievance ethos. That is a singular through line in all of the jurisprudence. The idea that social conservatives, religious conservatives, and really the modern Republican Party are the victims of a society or different groups that don't share their views. So you mentioned how they are projecting this energy onto just about everything they encounter. Just to take an example, you know, Sam Alito has written into Supreme Court opinions that you cannot say that marriage is between a man and a woman anymore. Now, of course, you can say that. He's been saying it for over a decade. What he means is people criticize you for it, and society doesn't share that view for the most part. And so, therefore, that makes him, Sam Alito, the victim.
But here's the thing. Here's the thing that sort of pops my mind. So the hell what? So the hell what? The country, there's a whole lot of shit that's said in this country that rubs people the wrong way, but it doesn't change the underlying facts or the truth. And if we've adjudicated something like marriage, gay marriage, just as we adjudicated the marriage between a Black man and a Black woman in the 1960s, And the court looked at the culture and the society and said, this is moving the country forward. This is the best outcome under the law, right? Under the Constitution. Why the hell are they so triggered? Because people say marriage is, I mean, it's a civil thing unless you're hyper-religious. I mean, I'm Catholic, and so, yeah, there are limits on what the church will recognize, right? But shit, the church doesn't ain't too happy when a Catholic marries a Protestant. what the hell are we saying here?
Well, look, no one is requiring Sam Alito to marry anyone. He can still do as he pleases. And yet he is still, as you say, deeply triggered by the world around him. It's in a lot of ways a deeply anti-conservative philosophy that he has, because what he's basically saying is there is a singular, single ideology that is the only acceptable one for anyone to express. And it is really, I think, an un-American view of dissent or speech, because he's saying, you know, it is a problem for people to criticize me. And when I am a dissenter, that means something has gone wrong. But of course, that is not how the American constitutional system is supposed to work.
No, how did we become so broken? I can tell you, a lot of what you've written tracks from my experience inside the party.
I appreciate that.
The whole grievance industry within the party, because folks, it has become an industry. There's a lot of money being made off of making sure you're pissed off enough to write a check. You know, they may want you pissed off enough to go vote, but that depends on what the subject matter is. But they definitely want you pissed off enough to go write a check. So I've seen that part of it. But how did the Supreme Court? I mean, I know that the court, all of them, mm-hmm. bottom, top to bottom, were. In the crosshairs for the political class in the party. In other words, if we can get something in front of the courts and adjudicate it, we get enough of our people on the court, then this issue will change. We can begin to roll back the accretion of liberalism into the society, because we think the country is inherently conservative. Hands Made Tales is a beautiful storyline. If only we could put it into practice, right? How did we get here? How did it become so broken that the court allowed itself to become? Because it's not just appointing Thomas and Alito. I mean, Thomas. No. I've known Thomas a long time. He never in the beginning struck me. It's like a lot of the crap that I see right now among Republicans. This is not how they started out, but then maybe I was wrong, and that's how they always were. I mean, help me kind of contextualize.
No, I think it's a complicated story, and it is partially a story that you were alluding to, which is the conservative legal movement, the Republican Party, decided to focus on the Supreme Court and basically create a very effective judicial screening mechanism for them to identify people who they felt confident would vote their preferred way. Now, I also agree with you that at the moment you appoint someone, that person is probably not the way Sam Alito is today. And right. in a lot of ways, when these individuals were appointed to the Supreme Court, like Clarence Thomas, the Republican Party looked different than it did today. And so what they also did is they created this alternative ecosystem that was designed to reinforce the views of the Republican Party and to reward the justices for continuing to track the evolving views of the Federalist Society. I just said Federalist Society rather than Republican Party, Freudian slip, because that's right. what the Federalist Society is there to do. And the founders.
And I was once a member. I was yeah. once a member of the Federalist Society as a young lawyer coming out, having been involved in a number of conservative activities. And again, even there, unless it was something that was in the back room, there was still this high regard and reverence for the federal judiciary, especially the Supreme Court, Leah. And no one wanted to break that. But the politics began to renegotiate those terms and put in motion by putting the finger on the scale of the types of candidates that were running, the types of candidates who were being nominated to the bench, coming out of the political activism side yep. of the Republican Party, as opposed to the judicial side of the Republican Party, young men and women who just wanted to be damn good lawyers. Yes, they had conservative philosophies and points of view, but it wasn't this idea that it was politically driven. It was how they read the Constitution. That's where you get, you know, the originalist perspective and all of that. And we sit here now and go, WTF, what? How? Why? And so I guess, you know, you sit there and you look at these pieces. You write that the Supreme Court is no longer practicing law, but instead practicing the politics of conservative grievance. And we touched on that. What is the juxtaposition of that practice around the sort of tried and true anchors of our constitutional government? Is that what we're seeing now and being chipped at and cracked at, is going at some of those foundational things where they're now using originalist intent to sort of warp outcomes of decisions to further a political agenda?
I definitely think so. And I think one of the most striking things is when originalism doesn't provide the tools to do so, the appointees who were promoted and nominated by an organization and presidents who professed adherence to and fealty to originalism are happy to abandon originalism. They are more than happy just to stick with the preferred outcome. So, for example, in the book, I talk about Shelby County versus Holder, the key decision that dismantled a key provision of the Voting Rights Act. In that case, the court did not bother to rely on originalism because, had they done so, they would have looked back to the Civil War and found, guess what the Reconstruction Congress did? What? It treated the former Confederate states a little differently. And so, right, like instead, Chief Justice Roberts just writes into the opinion, this violates this new principle identified in the Constitution, equal sovereignty, because it has made the former Confederacy and Southern Republicans into victims by discriminating against them and punishing them. And so that is just one example of where they are jettisoning law in favor of feelings and the political talking points of the segregationists who initially opposed the Voting Rights Act.
That is such a, it is so profoundly galling to me to now hear, you know, Alito and Thomas especially, but then others articulating the arguments that were made to keep slavery in place and using that as justification to undo the Voting Rights Act or to go after transgender people. It is one of those things where that, you know, they claim a victimhood, but they are victimizing everyone around them because they're not white, they're not Anglo-Saxon, they're not Christian. they are, in their view, amoral or immoral. And no court should sit in judgment of any of that. And yet they do. The only thing they should be charged with doing is your right to make a decision about your body, the right to make a decision about what you believe, how you want to educate your kids, where you want to live, who you want to marry. Those rights are inherent in our Constitution and therefore are protected. And anything that the state does to violate that right, that protection, we step in and go, nope, sorry, they have the right to do that. This court now starts with grievance. How aggrieved are you? How put upon are you by the fact that you, poor little baker, have to bake a cake for two men who want to get married? Oh my God, my world is upended. I will never be the same. I can't look my children in the eye because I baked your damn cake.
And you don't have to go to the wedding.
You don't have to live like that, boo. Guess what? We'll not only say that you don't have to bake the cake, but not a baker in the country has to bake a cake for a gay couple ever again. So everybody can go home and be comforted knowing that.
This is part of why I call the court lawless, because in my view, they have inverted the concepts of equality and discrimination. Right? Like, they call equality and civil rights protections for the LGBT community discrimination against the religious and social conservatives who are opposed to LGBT equality. You know, that area of law is in a lot of ways the peak of the conservative grievance energy. You know, this past term, the Supreme Court has on its docket a case about whether public schools can include LGBTQ reading materials in their instruction. And so there, it's not even a baker or a website designer has to do something related to a same-sex wedding. It is merely reading a book that has a character of a man who marries a man or a lesbian wearing a leather jacket. That too is now so profoundly offensive that it victimizes the parents with religious beliefs that oppose LGBT equality. And it is cannibalizing all of law, that grievance energy.
You start the book, and just, I told y'all, see, y'all wouldn't believe me. See, y'all need to go get something stronger and put in that cup of coffee, because I'm telling you, trust me, it's going to get worse.
We're only on chapter two.
We're only on chapter two. You don't know, folks. You note other courts, by contrast, this is in reference to January 6th rulings that the Supreme Court put out. And folks, y'all remember how you felt watching real time the Supreme Court go, hold the hum, the head, the ha, the ho, the ha, the ho, the ha, right? Ignoring the fact that there was a train that had left the station on what happened on January 6th, and the conductor of the train was the friggin' president of the United States, and they refused to do anything to address that. So they figured they would find every way they could to slow that train down. And you note other courts, by contrast, had concluded that the 14th Amendment barred Trump from holding office under the provision that disqualifies people who, after having taken an oath to the United States, quote, engage in insurrection or rebellion against the same, end quote. All of the Supreme Court's January 6th related interventions cleared the way for Trump to run for president again and to ultimately be reelected. So taking the political piece, and this is why I kept arguing that the courts would not save us at that time. That the courts would be the problem, because the political class was effed. They were gone. They were full of shit. We know what Republicans in the Senate were. Mitch McConnell, for all the blathering, wasn't doing jack. He could have stopped all of this, America, if he just allowed the senators who wanted to vote to convict Donald Trump in the second impeachment trial had done so. So that's the starting point. Take that off. That's the politics. The judicial side of this is where you start us on the train that you're putting us on, rolling out of the station saying, wait a minute, you're not going, you're not even, not only are you going to not reach the destination, the conductor of the train now is the Supreme Court, and they actually want the train to stop to give Trump the time that he needed so that at the end of the day, as you note here, they cleared the way for him to run for president again. What did that tell you when you were watching that evolve at that time and the myriad of cases that were coming up through the system in which the Supreme Court go, oh, okay, we'll get to that, because they're quick to dump on stuff, right? They'll pull stuff out onto their docket in a heartbeat. But those cases, they were like, we'll get to them.
So I was also very much of the view that the courts aren't going to save us. And to my mind, that entire episode and other events related to it underscored that the court is enabling and emboldening the worst elements of the Republican Party, including Donald Trump. I'm glad you mentioned Mitch McConnell, because of course our biggest problem is you have the canonical bad man, right, occupying the office of the leader of the free world. But it is equally problematic that the people around him are enabling his worst instincts. And that includes the Republican justices on the Supreme Court. Because in the case where they said 14th Amendment, states can't enforce it against Donald Trump, the victimization grievance energy came out. Where during the oral argument in that case, you had Clarence Thomas suggesting the entire project of Reconstruction, including the 14th Amendment, was actually about irrational hatred toward the South, rather than what was necessary to enforce civil rights. And
so let's just put a pause in that. So the black man on the Supreme Court says that the 14th Amendment was basically the result of an irrational, what was that?
Hatred.
Hatred of the South, irrational hatred of the South, the very same South that had his grandpappies, great grandpappies in irons and chains with lashes on their backs, the same South where his grandfather, whom he idolizes, who was the heartbeat of Clarence Thomas, couldn't drink at a water fountain. The very same South that told him he couldn't marry the woman that he's currently married to. That irrational hatred? Is that what we're talking about? I'm sorry. I didn't mean to.
I think you needed some wine as well, Michael, for this episode, a stiff drink.
I can't even begin to process that shit. I just can't. But go ahead, Leah. I'm sorry.
Yeah. And, you know, you mentioned
this for a moment.
No, the Supreme Court can go quickly when it wants. You know, when people were rushing off to the Supreme Court to challenge Biden administration policies, or the Trump administration is now asking the Supreme Court for permission to implement various policies like the ban on transgender service members, the Supreme Court can act within days or weeks. Instead, in the immunity ruling, when special counsel Jack Smith asked the Supreme Court to take up the case in December, they just sat on it and said no, waited to do so until February. That's a 2-month delay. And then when they did, they scheduled the argument for the end of April, an additional 2-month delay. That guaranteed Donald Trump was never going to face trial on these election interference charges before he went to run for re-election and people went to vote. And it's hard for me to escape the idea that some of the Republican justices looked at Jack Smith's prosecutions and thought, that's just Trump derangement syndrome, right? Like, they are just persecuting Donald Trump for being a Republican. And again, when that is your worldview, when you are so convinced of that, facts, law, reality are just not going to get in the way of it. And it's bulldozing through all of those possible constraints on the Supreme Court.
They did not persecute Donald Trump. They prosecuted him for crimes that he committed. How do you lose sight of the fact that the man committed the crimes? That, I mean, he was convicted on 34 counts, people. We heard him on the audio tape trying to bribe or cajole or whatever word you want to use the election officials in the state of Georgia. We know about the readout of his trying to get Volodymyr Zelensky to falsify documents or evidence that the Bidens were involved in some heinous activity in Ukraine. I mean, how do you, I don't see, this is the part, and you said something that I think it's important to note in all of this. Whether it's the Supreme Court, whether it is what we see currently playing out in the second term of the administration, is that the victimhood is the thing for them, right? And everything that comes at that victimhood to show that it's bullshit and a lie and is nothing more than a cover for the grift, for the criming that's going on, for the illegal activities, for the bad behavior that we see playing out, they fall on Trump derangement syndrome. Well, I wouldn't be deranged if this MF-er didn't do the shit that he did. I mean, you ever stop and think about what would drive me in the first place to be deranged? I just don't wake up in the morning mad at something that I don't know anything about or mad at something that you've done that you didn't do. I mean, so this is the part that drives me nuts, is how they're allowed to, and I guess the worst part of it is how it's seeped into the court in such a way in which you have the Supreme Court justices getting bought off with yacht trips and buying, you know, paying for their kids' educations and all this other bullshit, and their spouses sitting up there acting as political extension of their will. You know, I mean, Jenny Thomas is a full-on MAGA insurrectionist, for God's sakes. And yet, you know, oh, well, it's just the wife of the Supreme Court justice. I mean, you know, pillows do talk, baby. I mean, so how do you explain that? Because you get him to, for example, you talk about the flags, you know, at Alito's house, and everybody, and the man threw his wife under the bus, and everybody was like, gosh. Wow, you know.
No honor. It's always someone else's fault. It's never his. It's
someone else's fault.
Even if it's his wife's.
How do we begin to turn this around? You know, throughout this book, and sometimes you say directly, and then, of course, in some of the examples you give, the court has to be changed. I mean, there's no doubt about that. I don't know if we're going to be able to convince people fully of what that change should be. Certainly, when the change comes, the MAGA conservatives will lose their shit. There's no doubt about that. They'll claim all. They'll be falling out all over the place. Right? Screw them. Because they're the problem. You know, you can say a lot of things about liberals, but they never did shit like this. They never abused the system so profoundly. I disagree with the decisions some of the liberal courts have, you know, ruled over the years. But the system has a way of addressing that and accounting for that, correcting if it's something that's out of the mainstay. You know, certainly, you know, there have been rulings of the Supreme Court with respect to members of my community that didn't start out too well, but we had to fix them, you know, in the Jim Crow era. Certainly when you get to the point of a Brown versus Board of Education situation, or the Civil Rights and Voting Rights Act, to try to correct for some of those earlier rulings. Okay, but that's a natural process of things. How do we begin now to sort of, I see it as an infection. How do you get the infection out of the system?
I think part of it starts with just public education and public information. You know, part of the goal of this book was just to socialize people in a different picture of the Supreme Court. And we've been joking about, you know, you need a stiff drink and this is a bleak story. And For sure, all of that. But I wrote the book in a way that is also meant to be kind of fun, you know, inviting people to mock the justices.
You did.
And making politics and political protests fun. So I think the first step is begin to invite other people to see the ways in which the Supreme Court is so flawed so that when we are at that later moment and MAGA doesn't control the entire machinery of the state, then there are enough people who are convinced we actually do need to make some systemic change to our institutions in order to reinforce our democracy. And we can have a debate about different ways of addressing the Supreme Court. You know, in the final chapter of the book, the conclusion, I note, you know, I think term limits would be a good idea of just regularizing appointments. I think limiting the Supreme Court's authority would be a great idea so they can't strike down laws like the Voting Rights Act. Now, in order to do those things, I also tend to think, at least me personally, you would need to expand the number of justices on the Supreme Court because this court won't let you do those things. Now, I don't think anyone has to have any particular set of ideas about how to fix the Supreme Court. But I do think, and I have hope, that a majority of the country, if they were clued into what these guys and Amy were up to, they would agree there is a problem.
Okay. We're going to catch our breath. Take a quick little break here. The book Lawless, How the Supreme Court Runs on Conservative Grievance, Fringe Theories, and Bad Vibes. The author, Leah Littman. I'm going to go refill this.
I've got my cup.
And when we come back, we're going to get into some of the rulings that have come down, where you think this court is going to go next with some potential cases that are coming in the system, and a whole lot more with Leah Littman right after this. Hey, folks, welcome back to the Michael Steele podcast. Okay, I'm ready. All done. We're ready to go round two with Leah Littman, author of Lawless. It's about the Supreme Court. It's a great book, folks. There are points where, you know, I go back and I'm looking at my notes, Leah, and I'm just going, why? What? Why do they do this? This makes no sense. What the hell? You know, how can people not see this? And it really says a lot about two things. One, something that I mentioned this earlier in our conversation when you were first being introduced about how I saw 30 years ago, 40 years ago. Now I'm coming up on my 50th anniversary as a Republican next year. So I've been in the room a long time. But the one thing consistently in that room throughout that time has been the courts. Liberals were so concerned about, oh, we got to get this bill passed and we need to change this law and we need... And conservatives are like, okay, y'all gonna do that. I need that judiciary. Because it doesn't matter who's the president of the United States. Because we get the court that we want, whether it's the federal district court, whether it's the appellate court, whether it's the Supreme, especially if it's the Supreme Court, we good. And that's essentially what's happened. And where I think it came home to roost for a lot of folks when finally the friggin' light bulb went on, was the Dobbs decision. Because they didn't see that coming after 50 years, when that was exactly what the conservatives were going for, gunning for. All those marches on Washington in January, in the snow, in the rain, in the cold, that was the facade of what was happening at the judicial level, and it was the machinations and original thinking of Mitch McConnell that really put it into motion, and that was on the Merrick Garland appointment. Connect those two dots, if you can, when you look at the arc of how we got here, where at critical points, Republicans in the Senate held the line and pushed forward with that aspect of the end game. And that for me was symbolized in this sort of feckless response to the Merrick Garland appointments and the subsequent appointments to the Supreme Court, in which when the Democrats were in a position to control, they were like, oh, you can't appoint at this time. No, I'm sorry. Barack Obama can't make an appointment, you know, right before an election. And then when it's Trump, is like, oh, you can appoint him on election day. That's fine. It's no problem.
What's that election day rule? Don't know her. So the Merrick Garland, I agree, story encapsulates so many of the relevant dynamics here, because when Justice Scalia unexpectedly passed away, that gave President Obama the opportunity to change the composition of the Supreme Court. And that would have changed the ideology and the ideological makeup of the court. And so what did Mitch McConnell do? He announced a blockade basically right after Justice Scalia had passed away and said, we're not going to let Obama appoint anyone to the court. And I think he was able to do that in part because the Republican Party had already convinced the entire party that they needed to focus on the court. So they understood the importance of holding the line. And McConnell also understood that because the party had been talking to their base about the importance of the courts, that holding open that seat would also benefit them in the 2016 election. And so Republicans' investment in the courts at that point paid a ton of dividends. So they held open the seat, they preserved the ideological makeup of the Supreme Court. And then sure enough, when Justice Ginsburg passes away a month, right, 6 weeks before the election, they go ahead and confirm Justice Barrett while the election is already underway and people are already casting their ballots. And I agree with you, it was very striking when the Supreme Court eventually heard Dobbs, the case that ultimately overruled Roe, to hear people on the left and the center express the view that the Supreme Court wasn't going to overrule Roe. What are you talking about? Even though that is what the Republican Party had been promising to do for over two decades. I mean, even after the argument, when I thought it was perfectly clear, I was on podcasts and different shows having debates with people who still claimed the Republican justices weren't going to overrule Roe. And I think that kind of delusion and failure to see what the Republican Party has actually become and what they have done to the courts is at the base of many of the problems we now find ourselves in.
That cuts back to the point you were making before the break about the composition of the court itself in a future administration. I think it's going to take, first off, Democratic Party, looking at it from that perspective, with an overwhelming number of seats in the House and Senate. To do that, I'm talking damn near supermajority in the Senate, and certainly in the House, a 20 plus seat majority, in order to begin to put into place the changes. So, but for the record, and you can clarify for our audience, the idea of changing the composition and the makeup of the court is wholly constitutional, is wholly in the realm, in the purview of the Congress, since the Congress writes the checks for the court. And it is not outside of what can be done. We've had a court with more than nine justices. Mm-hmm. We've had a court with as few as six justices. So this is not something that's etched in stone. Very much like our primary in the political system is not etched in stone. We can throw that shit out very easily. We don't need primaries. We can just have everybody in the pool, and the top five of y'all go to a general election and we'll do ranked choice voting and we're done. I just saved a lot of money, a lot of pain in the ass, and you'll have an election in which people participate. But that's another conversation. The point is that you can fix this structurally with headache, yes. Mm-hmm. A lot of blowback from conservatives who will whine like, you know, little cats about what's happening. But it is something that is likely going to be necessary in order to begin to excise this poison out of the body of the judiciary.
Yes. So you're right. Congress has changed the size of the Supreme Court repeatedly over time. You know, the Constitution doesn't say anything about the number of justices. I think what many people might not realize is the Constitution actually allows Congress to decide whether to create the lower federal courts, the federal trial courts and appellate courts at all. So the Constitution requires there to be a Supreme Court, but does not right? Like indicate what size that Supreme Court has or what the scope of its authority has to be. And so Congress has expanded the size of the Supreme Court. They've reduced the size of the Supreme Court, sometimes in response to politics. So they didn't want, for example, you know, a future president of a different party to be able to appoint justices. And so they reduced the size of the court, or they expanded the size of the Supreme Court in order to account for, again, wanting to change the dynamics within the court. So this is absolutely something that Congress could do if it wanted. I agree with you. This is going to require significant margins for the Democratic Party. And that's part of why I think the first step is just public campaigning, public organization to educate people about what the court is doing to build that base within the Democratic Party and that energy among independents and Democrats. Because the Democratic Party, as it exists now, does not have the political will to do that. I mean, at the end of Biden administration, they agreed with Republicans. They negotiated to not confirm some federal court of appeals judges. And it was like, my guys, you're in the majority.
What
is this deal you're doing? So,
Leah, I could tell you stories about the level of stupid that you sit in these conversations. You go, you know, they're punking your dumb ass right now with all of this. And you guys are sitting there negotiating. You're negotiating with the judicial terrorists. You're negotiating with your political terrorists. Why are you doing this? And the whining level. And this is the difference politically between the two parties. Again, the Republicans have focused for 100 years now on power.
Yes.
I mean, this goes back to the 1920s, Hoover. This goes back definitely to Roosevelt. Roosevelt triggered Republicans like you wouldn't believe when he decided to, okay, I'm just going to turn all of this around with the New Deal, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm going to try to pack the court, right? And they got triggered as hell. And they have been triggered ever since. And it's just amazing to me that on the opposite side of that, the Democrats never really fully appreciated or figured out over this last 100 years that they're working with or against a political party that is not right. It just isn't right in so many respects when it comes to these things. And I love how you talk about, because with the justices now, certainly you've got, you know, this idea of originalism. They just sort of throw it around. You note in the book, originalism offered a way of advancing an ideological agenda. Just on its own terms, originalism lends itself to that end, since a key premise of originalism is that the Supreme Court has erred in departing from some righteous past that must be restored. And you go on and you get into that piece. And so you could see how that thinking over time hardens into something very twisted. And that's the piece that we now are living in, whereas it's not just, oh, okay, we're just going to slow roll a decision to give the criminal president, the convicted felon, time to get on the other side so he can't be duly prosecuted, et cetera, for the crimes he's alleged to have committed. But it goes deeper than that. It goes into how it's going to look at and rule on things down the road as well, because of this past that has to be restored.
I mean, the past that has to be restored, I think part of what is so striking is that the political slogan the Republican Party eventually found their way to, Make America Great Again, contains that same promise of restoring this righteous past when the country was, in fact, not so great for many groups that are not, by and large, part of the modern Republican coalition. And so I think part of what originalism was able to do is it was able to send the same message that the Republican Party is now sending explicitly in electoral politics, but without having to say that, even though enough people understood what you were saying, without having to do that. And then you're right, it morphed into this very, very heavy-handed effort to restore and reinstate a system where, again, the constituencies that are part of the modern Republican Party exercised outsized political power. They had a monopoly on politics, and they had, you know, better social standing because their views used to be more popular. And so that is the world they want to restore. You know, I appreciated how you said the Republican Party has been fixated on power, political party power, for the last century, because the Republican justices on the Supreme Court have very much been in lockstep with that same project, whether it comes to enabling partisan gerrymandering, not allowing Democratic presidents to govern. Like, they are focused on entrenching the Republican Party's political power because they recognize, like, that party now depends on minority rule.
Because they can't govern.
Right.
They can't govern. I mean,
I literally include a quote from the Michigan Republican Party that says, be ungovernable. And it's like,
yep.
Why they is that can't your, govern, your slogan?
It is what you nailed it. That's why I was about to bring you, I'm glad you brought. I was going to say that because where I was going, they can't govern. And you know what's even sadder than not being able to govern is not wanting to govern.
Yes.
Because then you've just given up completely. Everything is political. Everything is based on how you grab and hold on to more power.
Yeah.
It's not just me saying this, folks. You live through this crap. I mean, we lived through 4 years of infrastructure week when you couldn't even pass a damn infrastructure bill. We lived through 4 years. Oh, repeal and replace Obamacare. Okay. Where's your bill? Given that Obamacare was the conservative heritage plan from the 1990s, Mitt Romney's plan when he was governor of Massachusetts, where's yours now? You got the basis. Okay, give us a new plan. Nope, couldn't do it. What's your environmental strategy? We are the party of the environment, right? Teddy Roosevelt, right? We love the lands. Oh, you just want to drill, baby, drill. My quote, I got it, right? But the idea, even drill, baby, drill was a policy. It was a concept. It was a plan. It was something that says, okay, this is how we're going to make ourselves more energy sufficient. More independent. Okay, we can have that debate. We can put that in legislation. But when you then have immigration, oh my God, immigration. So here you bitch about immigration, right? And you finally get Republicans in the Senate working with Democrats to craft a bill. You get members in the House, in that House, that go, you know what? Okay, we can do this because we're going to lock down the borders. And Donald Trump tells you, no, I want to be able to run on it. I want to use it as a political weapon against Joe Biden. And they go, okay. So this idea that we don't govern is at the heart of a lot of this. The other side of it that is very scary, and you wrote about this, is the space, the DEI space, the criminalization of DEI, yeah. Diversity, equity, and inclusion. And I will continue to remind people who espouse the anti-DEI bullshit that, but for the diversity, your ancestors would not have been able to come here. But for equity, your ancestors would not have been able to find economic prosperity and success. But for inclusion, your ancestors would still be living in ghettos. So what the hell's your problem? And this idea that these white Republicans, these MAGAs, think that somehow their little white child, their little white child is disadvantaged because, oh my God, you've got to learn about Black history. Oh my God, you're going to go into a workforce in which one day you're just going to be asked to work alongside someone who doesn't look like you, come from where you are, and that's okay. You talk about Kosciusko, I want to make sure I get it right.
Yeah, Kosciusko,
versus United States. And this case is a case that's not on anyone's radar, but it's on yours. And it talks about a plausible path, as you know, to criminally threaten some number of individuals and entities that maintain DEIA policies and practices. Talk about that case and talk about it in the context of what this court would be saying should it rule in that way.
Yeah. So the question in Kosciusko is whether the federal government can prosecute for wire fraud and mail fraud individuals who include a term in their contracts that doesn't necessarily have economic value, but if you don't abide by that term, can the federal government, again, prosecute you for basically wire fraud or mail fraud for including this term in the contract, even though it didn't affect the economic value of the contract, but you didn't abide by it? And the specific contract term in Kosciusko is the opposite of this. So this was an instance where a contractor asked their subcontractor, I want you to subcontract with a certain number of, you know, minority business enterprises, you know, make sure, right, like you are considering a diverse slate of subcontractors. That doesn't affect the price of the contract, but it mattered to the person asking for it. Here, the federal government prosecuted them because they said they didn't actually try to include a more diverse array of subcontractors. If the Supreme Court says that prosecution is fine, the federal government can impose criminal penalties on individuals who misrepresent something in a contract, even though it doesn't have economic value, you can imagine the federal government going after federal contractors whom the federal government is now forcing to say, we don't have DEI programs, we're not engaged in violations of Title VI and Title VII as the Trump administration understands those laws. And the Trump administration has taken the view that federal civil rights laws prohibit DEI programs. So what if the Trump administration uncovers the fact that one of these federal contractors has a DEI program? Could they threaten them with criminal liability? This is something that now, you know, is a big outstanding question in white collar criminal law. And we're all kind of waiting to see whether the Supreme Court might narrow the reach of this wire fraud, mail fraud statute.
I have no faith in this court. In that regard, I think they will criminalize DEI because that's what this administration wants. That's what the predicate of this case is all about. I mean, when the President of the United States puts a ban on DEI across the federal government, but then celebrates Black History Month in the White House, you know, it tells you exactly where they want to go. You know, folks, here's the nub of it. I can tell you, as the former lieutenant governor of my state who reformed our minority enterprise business, and I reformed it because what was happening was white contractors who are the big dogs in the contracting industry, whether it's in the construction side, on the road side, whatever. They typically would find one Black contractor to satisfy some quota system somewhere, and that's it. So you have a whole lot of other subcontractors who want to be primary contractors one day, but you know how it is. You got to find the work to get to play. But you don't get to get the work nor get to play because either they're not required to diversify their contract, or when they do, they find one and they stick with that one and that's it. So we tried to reform that to say, look, and I haven't even had this conversation. I said, look, there are a whole lot of contractors out there you can do business with who probably give you a better deal, right? Right? So, but the idea now that you can't do that, that had, to your point, Leah, in the Kosciusko case, that has nothing to do with the value of the contract. In fact, if there's any value at all, it's largely in the fact that you're now sort of widening the breadth of opportunities for contractors in that community, in that state, in that region, to participate in something that they otherwise would not be able to participate in. And so diversity, equity, inclusion is about that. It's not just to the exclusion, because here's the other thing. there are a lot of female-owned contractors who also would benefit from that, mm-hmm. from that DEI effort. You know, so, and we know that the largest beneficiary of affirmative action programs have been white women.
Yep.
Who have benefited from the fact that their white husbands who have the contract hired them to be the subcontractor. So it's ludicrous to me that you have the court now on the verge, I think, and I really hope I'm proven wrong, of basically criminalizing those relationships that do not have an economic, a negative economic impact. No one's lying or hiding anything when the contract says, oh, we'd love, this is my contract, Leah. I'd like you to, when you're subcontracting, I'd like you to hire two or three women-owned businesses to be a part of it.
Mm.
Okay, so who did I hurt?
Right.
Who got hurt just now? Who I'm sorry, hurt?
Sam Alito.
There it is. Okay. I don't know where to go next. This is you write such a good story, and you do engage. You folks, she engages you so much on this book, as you could probably tell. I'm hyped on this book. I love the fact that in the book you compare the Supreme Court to the movie Mean Girls.
Yes.
Yeah, I made a special note of that. So let's talk about that before we go. What are the similarities that you see there, and how does that track to Arrested Development, Game of Thrones? Connect all those dots for us.
So all of the chapters have different pop culture motifs. You know, as I suggested, I tried to make the book engaging, fun, inviting, because the underlying story is enraging. I'm glad you like the Mean Girls chapter. That one gave me more than a few giggles.
It's good.
Yeah,
it's
good. That is the motif for the chapter on LGBT equality, because of course in Mean Girls, you know, Regina George insists that everyone is obsessed with her, including her ex-friend Janice Ian, who's a lesbian. Yes. And therefore she couldn't have her at the pool party. And I think the Supreme Court's Republican justices have very Regina George energy, and that they too are insistent on the idea that gays and lesbians are obsessed with them and out to get them and other religious and social conservatives, and therefore they need to banish them from society. So that's the Mean Girls chapter. And then, yeah.
Go ahead. Go ahead. Game of Thrones is...
Game of Thrones is the voting rights chapter. It's designed to capture the brutality of the Republican Party, including the Republican Court's commitment to political power, kind of likening them to the warring factions in Game of Thrones. It also allowed me to say, you know, there is a Mad King in our story as well, and make that allusion. Yes. So, yeah, I had fun writing the book. I hope people have fun reading it. You know, it is a sad, bleak story, but one that I think everyone needs to know about.
Well, it is, again, and there's so many other aspects that we did not get into in a deep way, but you do. For example, how the Supreme Court is in its way creating the very oligarchy that we are talking about and seeing. And what that may mean in underlying, you know, what this country is about and the balance between the haves and the have-nots and so forth. And we see that with the sort of whining and dining of the Supreme Court justices in a very specific way. I mean, why would I rule against someone who just paid for my stepson's college? Or pays, you know, $250,000 for me to go on vacation with them. Why would I ever rule against their interest?
Yeah. you know, it's an influence and access scheme. And because the Supreme Court has declared that basically buying influence and access to political officials isn't corrupt, they have enabled, you know, the mega rich to buy influence and access to the Supreme Court as well. You know, one of the most stunning lines, I think, in the Supreme Court's opinion is from Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission, where they suggested that massive amounts of political spending would, of course, not lead to the appearance of corruption and not cause Americans to lose faith in our democracy. And I think we've all seen what Elon Musk did, pour in several hundred millions of dollars and thereby basically purchase himself the presidency and access to the presidency. And you're telling me that doesn't give off the stench of corruption and doesn't cause people to question our democracy? Come on, get real.
Get real. Well, you do in this book. It's fun. It's frightening. It's enraging at times. But you keep us focused on the core interest here, and that is how the court is being changed and how it in turn is changing us and what we are as a country. Lawless, how the Supreme Court runs on conservative grievance, friends theories, and bad vibes. Leah Littman, this was so much fun. I enjoyed the conversation. I hope folks out there did as well. I hope you enjoyed it, Leah.
I did. I really appreciate your time and kind words, Michael, making room for a discussion about this book. It really means a ton. Obviously, I'm a huge fan. Watch you on MSNBC all the time.
I appreciate that. I appreciate that very much. So, folks, the book is out now. Go get the book. It is, look, I'm telling you straight up, you know, you're going to have your sort of, okay, the books I want for summer reading. This is on the book list for summer reading. It'll be with you at the pool. Cause that way you can just keep telling the pool boy, bring another umbrella drink, please.
Or you can take a dip in the pool when you need to cool off.
Exactly. I'm about to turn into the Mean Girls chapter. So, but Leah, thank you so much, for taking time writing the book, you know, helping us understand exactly what's happening right now. So we really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Folks, that does it for our time together. I really appreciate you for spending that with me here on the Bulwark platform, the Michael Steele podcast. Please don't forget to download and like and love, because it makes me feel all yummy and a little less crazed. But anyway, you know what I'm about to tell you. As we get ready to head into the summer with Memorial Day, just a couple of weeks away, I don't want you playing with stupid. Okay. Stop playing with stupid. Just go find a new set of friends. Stupid's not helping you right now. Until next time, guys, be good, be safe.